course, in the back of every magazine, there were usually classified ads for other people's zines. And because of the desktop publishing boom, everybody and anybody was taking advantage of this new technology to whip out their own little screed. The truth movement, it's one of those things, it's like, I can't believe how many years have passed. It shocks me because it's still so fresh to me and yet old hat in so many ways. I am a very dualistic person, and I do wax and wane between at least two personalities that are both very much me, and those are the tired, I can't do this anymore, burned out, how have I done this so long side of me, and the other half is the, well, I don't care, because I'm still interested in these subjects. They still hold my attention, whether it's lucid dreams, parapsychology, UFO sightings, mind control research, parapolitical conspiracy, covert ops, psychological warfare, all that stuff, folklore, anthropology, psychedelics, you know, all this stuff is just fascinating to me. It always has been, and I strongly suspect always will be.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 3. It is May 11th, 2008. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. Before we dive into this week's episode, let me throw in a little plug here for our new BOA Audio podcast feed. If you somehow missed it at the beginning of last week's episode, the new URL for BOA Audio Podcasting is www.banalofamerica.podcast.xml. Take that URL and plug it into your podcast receiving software, and then you'll be able to access all the latest Banal of America audio episodes as they come rolling out. On to this week's episode, we have a fantastic show on tap for you. Our guest is one of the big players behind the scenes in Esoterica today, the prolific Smiles Lewis. He's going to be joining us for a two-hour jam session on all things esoteric. Looking at his 20 years of research, he's going to take us back to the zine scene of the 1980s and early 90s and talk about the explosion and evolution of Esoterica on the internet. We're going to take a look at big picture issues revolving around the UFO scene, UFOs in general, 9/11, and the growth of the 9/11 truth movement. Plus, we're going to find out about Smiles' various projects, which span the spectrum of esoteric media, and of course, tons and tons more. Lots of little side tangents, lots of laughs throughout the interview, lots of fun times. Like I said, it's an all-out jam session with one of the oftentimes unsung key figures in today's esoteric scene, Smiles Lewis. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Smiles Lewis, let me give you a little bit of background on him. He has a monstrous bio. You can check it out in full at the BOA page where you found this interview. I'm just going to hit the highlights here for you. Smiles Lewis has had a lifelong interest in all things anomalous. At an early age, proclivity at recalling his nightly dreams, as well as several personal experiences with ESP, precognition, and dream switching, bolstered his interest in the paranormal. Shortly after high school, he joined the local MUFON chapter in Austin, Texas. He would later become a MUFON state section director for that group, as well as leader of the local UFO experiencer support and study group. A lover of books, Smiles collected over 1,000 titles before founding his own nonprofit, Anomaly Archives, that serves as a lending library for the Scientific Anomaly Institute. For over 20 years, he has worked with digital audio, video, and other bleeding-edge internet technologies. He has published his own print journal, edited a local paranormal newspaper, maintained a large network of websites, organized a national UFO conference, spoken to anthropologists about UFOs and parapsychology, hosted both terrestrial and web radio talk shows, and has been podcasting since before the phrase existed. Smiles' current projects include co-hosting 3 different radio shows a week as part of the 18 unique shows, airing daily on the Anomaly Radio Network. His website is www.smileslewis.com, SmilesLewis.com. Check it out. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 20th, 2008. Smiles Lewis joins us for a two-hour esoteric jam session on BOA Audio Season 3.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. We have a very cool guest here on the line with us tonight for the program. He is tremendously prolific. He is behind so many different things in the world of esoterica, very well known by many of the researchers in the field. But he sort of operates behind the scenes in a lot of ways, but you see his name attached to so many projects. And obviously, I know him pretty well. I've been on his program, and I wanted to bring him in here on Banal of America Audio to discuss his experiences in the field. He's been in the field for quite a while, all the different paranormal fields, really, and all the different projects he's been working on. So our guest here is the prolific, profound, and very popular Smiles Lewis. Smiles, welcome to Banal of America Audio.
Wow, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out with the bio, the background. Who is Smiles Lewis, and how did you get interested in the paranormal and get, you know, all wrapped up in this mess?
I guess the quickest route is to say that at an early age, I had pretty significant ability at dream recall, and since dreams, to my estimation, are probably everybody's everyday experiencing of the paranormal, I think I just had a predilection for that from the very start. Being raised by an open-minded mother led me to, you know, always question authority, always kind of have a sense of a certain level of spirituality akin to Star Wars' The Force, while at the same time a predilection towards science and rationalism and looking for a balance between the two. So at a very young age, started looking into the strange, the mysterious, the anomalous, the occult, the esoteric, from a perspective of having a little personal experience with the paranormal. Growing up with my single mom, she and I had a pretty strong psychic bond, you could say, and there were several instances where it proved to my experiential self that psi and paranormal and ESP are real, and that, you know, if they're real, then there must be ways of exploring them and finding out more about them. And some of those experiences range from her showing her probable intuitive prowess by keeping us from being shot to death at a infamous shooting in San Antonio when I was in elementary school. We probably would have been dead if she hadn't been concerned about getting sunburned and moved us from where we had originally sat. But we also had experiences where both of us were suddenly aware of the other's distress remotely. And simple things like getting up and going to the car, knowing exactly where we were going, even though no words had been spoken, just that kind of a strong anecdotal, scientific, less than scientific experiences. And growing up with, you know, science fiction, being part of the Star Wars generation and growing up on reruns of Star Trek and then the going through high school with the Next Generation coming on the air and so forth, that definitely leaned me towards the wonderment about if we're alone in this big universe, and if we are, how freaking tragic that is, and if we aren't, then where's the evidence that there's anything else out there, and could it be here, and could it have always been here, and is it interacting with us more often than most people think?
Yeah.
And so I just kind of went from the experiential end of it and reading up on these subjects as a kid to right out of high school, finding the local Mutual UFO Network chapter and becoming active with it, and it had its own really interesting, unique history, and was really pleased to punch into it and meet so many amazing peoples and just kind of start the networking from there. And from there, I discovered the anomaly, or the zine scene of the 1990s, fresh out of high school, and that's how I met mutual friends of ours, such as Greg Bishop, who was doing Excluded Middle magazine, and a number of others that were on the scene at the time, thanks to Desktop Publishing. And just, I've always been a networker. I love meeting people and hearing stories, and of course, that's what these things are all about. They're all about stories, some of which actually have great physical evidence to back them up. Some of them, not so much, but either way, they often are very compelling, and it seems to me the stories end up being transformational very often, and not just for the individual, but ultimately for society as a whole. And that's where I think there's so many ways you can look into this. So it's just kind of like, gosh, I'm the kind of person who has so many different interests. I end up, as you were saying, with my name on a variety of different projects, and it's it sometimes is to the detriment of those individual projects, because it can be hard to focus on getting one thing done when you're working on so many different things. But, you know, anybody who knows themselves to have a predilection towards multiple hobbies and interests knows that, you know, well, you just kind of go where things take you.
Exactly, yeah. And I got to give you props to you, because you're involved in so much stuff. And, you know, you're ambitious and creative and, you know, like I said, just boundless energy, it seems. And a lot of people in the paranormal world, and I'm not faulting them. That's cool. They just want to read and not get involved. But you're involved in, like, so much stuff. It's amazing. So I got to give you props for that. Before we even sort of dive into stuff, you kind of piqued my interest here, because you said you sort of discovered the zine scene in the 90s and stuff. Talk a little bit about that era of paranormal research during that era, because it's a whole different world now with the internet and stuff, and I'm sure it was just a very unique and interesting experience back during the 90s during the zine phase.
Yeah, it was a real exciting time. As I was looking out there for different resources, I found, of course, MUFON, and the Mutual UFO Network had, you know, the largest civilian UFO research organization on the planet, and had a monthly journal that had been going on for decades. And so it just seemed natural to since I worked at the local public library, and I was seeing the monthly issue of the MUFON journal, because the library was subscribed to it. It was like, okay, is there a local group? Hey, heck, there is a local group. And wow, you know, they had just kind of started up. They'd been going for just a little while when I met up with them, fresh out of high school in 1990, thereabouts. And they were starting to do local events and train local investigators. And they had a real interesting core of people who were plugged into some of the historic, past, modern, early modern UFO era. And just, of course, in the back of every magazine, including the MUFON Journal, there were usually classified ads, and you'd see in those classified ads ads for other people's zines. And because of the desktop publishing boom, everybody and anybody was taking advantage of this new technology to whip out their own little screed. And I think Adam Gorightly has often said that he created his own zine specifically so that he could trade it with other people and get other zines for free. And so there was this kind of network of people. And it's really interesting, because there's other offshoots of this that are more cultural than anomalous, but anomalous in and of themselves, and like people doing tape trading, like old cassette tapes. Like, they would make mixtapes and almost do like a telephone call, where each person that got the cassette mailed to them would add something onto it and send it on, and all kinds of wacky stuff like that, and through mailing lists and kind of snail mail pen pal type stuff. But yeah, it was a completely different scene, but you could look through those ads and find all manner of esoteric, occult, magical oriented, conspiracy oriented, UFO oriented, science, psychedelics, consciousness oriented magazines. And early on, I through the MUFON Journal discovered somebody was locally here in Austin doing a really cool new magazine called Crash Collusion, and that was this guy named Wes Nations. And I was just like, oh my God, I've got to meet this guy. So, you know, all us freaks, you know, we're always happy to meet our own kind, but at the same time, all us freaks know that there's a lot of other freaks out there, some of which are even freakier than us. So it's, there's always that kind of like standoffish, like, yeah, sure, we have some of the same interests, but you might be a psycho.
yes.
But eventually I was able to befriend this fellow, and he basically introduced me to the excluded middle crowd out in California, Greg Bishop, Peter Stenzel, and Robert Larson, all of whom are amazing individuals in and of themselves and have their own voluminous histories and have carried on the tradition of anomalous research in one way or another. And through them, I came to find out about Adam Gorightly and Jim Keith and Ken Thomas, and it was just – it's one of those things. When you're researching and networking, it's just – it's all intertwined. You just – one thing leads to another. It's what creates those octopus conspiracies. It's just everything can be connected in some way, and so you just leapfrog from one resource and networking point to the next, and at the end of it, you've got a lot of data points, some of which you can connect in rational ways, others that are just kind of strangely attracted to each other.
Yeah.
And it was completely different, though, then. It was like – it was a great feeling to go to one's P.O. box and, you know, digging through the spam, digging through the direct marketing crap, you'd be able to, you know, suss out and bring out these amazing new zines that were coming out at the time. And some of them were really slick, and some of them were just obnoxiously photocopied, you know, 10th generation, saddle stapled, you know, all crooked and stuff. And,
yeah.
It was really amazing. And it's interesting because in exploring UFOs and consciousness and psychotronic mind control and the weirder element, you come to find out about characters like Ira Einhorn, infamous in certain communities. The first guy that he emceed the first Earth Day, and then was later extradited from France to do time for the murdering of his girlfriend and putting her in a steamer trunk.
Oh wow!
And the reason why do I bring up such a crazy character? Because he was doing through zines, through the mail list operations, and through the earliest parts of the DARPA internet, thanks to Jacques Vallée, he was distributing information in the kinds of ways that now we take for granted as being, oh, that's just a mailing list on the internet. Oh, that's just a bulletin board. Oh, that's just, yeah, you know, a way of getting information out there using the latest technology. Well, he was cutting edge with that, and fortunately he was very unstable, apparently, and depending upon who you believe, he either was set up for, you know, discovering Tesla mind control technology or actually had some problems and killed his wonderful girlfriend Holly Maddox, which is really tragic either way if you look at it. And so yeah, completely different scene on the internet now, where it's so easy to find all these resources, you know, instantaneously, practically.
Yeah, this is a good segue actually, because that's kind of what I was going to ask you about, because you saw sort of the birth of the internet and now where it's at now, which is obviously you're on the cutting edge of what's happening on the internet as far as paranormal stuff goes. What do you think of the evolution of the esoteric on the internet? Do you think it's been good or bad or ugly? Obviously, it's been ugly. I mean, everything's on the internet's been ugly, but what do you think about sort of how it's come along and changed the paranormal world in a lot of ways?
I think it is amazing and astounding. It's also just, there's so much crap out there, and in some ways it's really diluted the quality, I think. The nuggets are still there, but it is harder to sift through them. At the same time, it's easy to be awed by the hoop and hollering of the sensational aspects. But, you know, if you've looked at UFOs, you know that there are really, you know, two sides to it. Like, there's two sides to everything, but in particular things like UFOs where, you know, here's something that's really deserving of hardcore rational scientific exploration, and severely lacking in that research angle. And yet, there's just so much out there about the subject, but so much of it is just the modern myth. It's the haystack, you know, that you have to go through to find the needle. There's so much noise out
yeah.
there. And I guess it's as much as I've felt like I was on the cutting edge of it, it's always been a matter of, well, I'm not well-funded, so it's still a real chore. And, you know, in some ways, I don't feel like I've been as voluminous as I have in other times. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, a lot of the times it's just it's not so much volume is not necessarily quality.
Yeah.
And certainly post 9/11, I was mostly concerned with, you know, volume and just getting, because there was so much information out there, so much of it disappearing, you know, so quickly, you know, mainstream news articles that are really important for people to know about, and then suddenly, you know, due to the newspaper trying to make money and charge for their archives, or just through their own stupidity, getting rid of links and, you know, and not maintaining content, and humanity losing access to that potentially really important information. It's a real tightrope, especially if you're not, like I said, if you're not operating from a position where you've got, you know, some kind of funding structure.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen the rise of organizations like NIDS, the National Institute of Discovery Science, where, you know, Robert Bigelow comes along and funds some of the brightest minds in the UFO and parapsychology communities to look at strange paranormal phenomena and come up with some amazing data, some amazing papers, you know, whether it be on the Flying Triangle reports or the cattle mutilation reports. NIDS did some fantastic stuff. Some great white papers came out of there. But where is it now? It's basically defunct. He's gone on. He was a hotel mogul to begin with, and now he's going to be a space hotel mogul. So he's come and gone. But we also have him to thank for Art Bell, you know, Coast to Coast AM. I mean, that wouldn't be around if it weren't for Robert Bigelow. you know, some guy coming along and saying, you know, I want to hear a nationally syndicated paranormal radio program. You seem like a good guy. Let's get you to do it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not that up on all the details, but that's the gist of it from what I gather. And, you know, there you go. We you know, modern ufology and paranormal wouldn't be as popular as it is if it wasn't for well-funded entertainment and programs like The X-Files and programs like Coast to Coast. So that's not to say that there wouldn't be quality content there if there wasn't the funding, because I think there are always these luminary shining lights who you know, come up with some amazing stuff with zero budget and just squeaking by in life. There's a lot of cases of really brilliant writers adding new perspectives to the UFO story and the paranormal investigative saga.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you've been doing this for quite a while, about 18, 20 years, let's say. That's a rough estimate, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you avoid the burnout of just being in this field for so long and dealing with the drama that comes with it from all the people in it, you know, and all that crap, and just, you know, the lack of answers in general, and how, you know, that can be kind of disenfranchising after a while. How do you avoid that burnout?
Well, that's a darn good question. I don't know, because I constantly feel burnout. but here I am. I'm still doing it, so
yeah.
I don't know. I guess it must be something inherent in my own psychological makeup. I know some folks who, you know, wrote really important works in the field of magic and UFOs and paranormal who've since donated their collections, their research collections, to one of my nonprofit groups, the Anomaly Archives Lending Library, because they're out of it. They're not interested anymore. And it, on the one hand, I'm like, how could you just drop all this? You know, it happens, and it's always a potential loss to humanity and the community of researchers at large when, you know, researchers fall out of interest with a subject and at worst throw their collections away, or at, you know, at best, you know, pass them on to a few select friends or co-researchers. The person I'm thinking of, you know, as I said, has wrote a number of works in the 90s anomaly zine scene, and also wrote at least one significant book, but this person isn't interested in those subjects anymore, and thankfully my nonprofit benefited from that donation. Similarly, you know, like we've taken the Dennis Stacy collection. Dennis Stacy was the editor of the MUFON UFO Journal for years, and of course, he and Patrick Weish are the guys behind Anomalist.com and Anomalist Books, and they're republishing so many great books and publishing new wonderful works. So they're still at it. He's still at it, you know, but he was kind enough to donate stuff that he didn't really need anymore. I guess, again, it's something in my psychological makeup. Perhaps it's because I as much as unstable as I often feel I am, mentally and emotionally, the fact is I am a very dualistic person, and I do wax and wane between at least two personalities that are both very much me, and those are the tired, I can't do this anymore, burned out, how have I done this so long, side of me, and the other half is the, well, I don't care, because I'm still interested in these subjects. They still hold my attention, whether it's lucid dreams, parapsychology, UFO sightings, mind control research, parapolitical conspiracy, covert ops, psychological warfare, all that stuff, folklore, anthropology, psychedelics, you know, all this stuff is just fascinating to me. It always has been, and I strongly suspect always will be. And I don't have any kids. That's another thing, of course. You know, somebody who's into this stuff, if they end up with a family, that can really kind of just go, you know, here's the really important thing, this little rugrat running around that I need to take care of.
Yeah, the real world can sometimes come crashing down on your paranormal interests and really take the steam out of stuff. And I think probably also it helps that you have a lot of diverse interests in the paranormal field. You know, if you were just into one subject, that would probably maybe contribute more to the burnout. But it sounds like, you know, if you get tired of looking at one thing, you have a lot of so many different interests that you can go look at something else for a while.
That's a very keen observation, yeah. And now that you mention it, that makes perfect sense. Because certainly, as much as I was focused on UFOs for so long, 9/11 changed that. You know, the big thing people know me for that didn't ever happen was the 2001 National UFO Conference. It was supposed to be a three-day, three-night extravaganza here in Austin at the then single location of the Alamo Drafthouse Theater Cinema, which now is franchise and huge, you know, multiple places all around the state and the country. And because of September 11th, that didn't happen. And everybody knows the world changed, and we went down a really weird reality tunnel ever since. And I was already parapolitically aware, but that certainly, you know, redirected most of my focus to, like, gosh, we've got a lot to do here, and, you know, things have gone on long enough in this, you know, effed up system. You know, we really need, you know, to start looking at how the powers that be run our lives. And so as much as I yearn to you know, dive back into UFOs, and every time I, you know, hear of a new researcher or a new perspective or some new book or Jacques Vallée coming out of retirement, you know, it's like, oh man, you know, I get so excited. And it's a nice distraction, because it's needed when you get so involved in the darker side of everything, whether it be ufology, parapsychology, cryptozoology, but particularly parapolitics. It's a dark, dark subject.
Yeah. Let's sort of dive into the UFO phenomenon, because it sounds like you said you were looking at it for quite some time. What's your overall thoughts, I guess you could say, on the UFO phenomenon? What do you think's going on here?
Well, I think that it's undeniable that humanity has always considered itself to be in contact with some sort of alien others, period. And if you accept that, you can go down the rational reductionist tack of, well, it's got to be all brain chemistry and misperception, and if there are extraterrestrials, we've got to hold that evidence to a high standard to prove its reality. Okay. But you can also go down the tack of, well, you know, it may be partially true. There may be, you know, some sort of intelligence or consciousnesses that are penetrating our reality on a regular basis throughout history. And if you look at the effects on the individuals and the cultures, that's one way of examining the phenomena as to whether or not it has any relevance or importance to humanity. And I would say, well, if it did in fact create the majority of the Earth's religions, that's a pretty significant thing to take into account, because religions are part of the power of the B structure, the PTB structure. You know, they're part of the parapolitical story. And if these things can come to anybody at any time, but at the same time seem predisposed to certain locations, there's a lot we can learn without even jumping to, you know, conclusions about extraterrestrials or angels or demons or gods or whatever. The point is, we've always believed ourselves to be in contact, so let's move on and explore this. And so I've been attracted by the works of folks like Jacques Vallée and John Keel, kind of a diverse crowd there. You know, you've got one guy who's just a journalist who's come up with some of the most profound ideas about UFOs and their other weird connections, John Keel, to Jacques Vallée, who I really consider a very scientifically minded, rational person, but who is also very knowledgeable about the occult and the esoteric and magic and those networks. And being a computer scientist and an astrophysicist, he's, you know, got quite a different perspective than your average UFO guy, and doesn't really like to be associated with most of your nuts and bolts UFO folk. And then you've got all the other points in between, these other people who put forth some really coherent ideas, either just explicating the physical evidence or going off into their own specializations. But my basic take is that there is a matrix of consciousness on this planet. We are a part of it, and there are certain locations and circumstances that seem to facilitate humanity's access to these other intelligences. And I think these intelligences range the gamut from being just literally, you know, manifestations of our own individual unconscious to manifestations of humanity's collective unconscious in a Jungian sense, to the actual communications by other species on this planet, or perhaps even species elsewhere. So you could have, I basically think that there's this, what I call transpersonal virtual reality communications channel, that the UFO is basically a VR encounter device, if you will,
okay.
Except that I don't think that they're always literally devices. I think that there are earth energies involved here, which is why you get time and time again these flap areas that are geographically centered. And so throughout history, humanity has interacted with these fields of energy that facilitate this contact with this other realm, and they're getting constant communications from, like I said, everything from their own individual unconscious to other species. Like I think, you know, it's part of the pattern of contact by quote-unquote hive-minded, insectoid, in some cases reptilian species is it could very well be true, because I also think that there could very well be a sliders-like, you know, multiple worlds aspect to these encounters, that people are accessing, you know, not just something that's a one dimension away or outside of our human perception, but something that may actually be in the same reality, or a slightly different reality than the one that we're inhabiting. My ideas mostly incorporate the ideas of certain researchers on this side of the pond and the other side of the pond over in England, and that's Dr. Greg Little is somebody who I think has done phenomenal work in his three books, The Archetype Experience, People of the Web, and Grand Illusions. All three of those detail his ideas that are akin to what I was just saying, that there's a geographic aspect. Then, of course, you've got, you know, Canada's Michael Pershinger, the Laurentian University researcher who has investigated the proximity of strange Fortean phenomena as well as UFO sightings along fault lines, and the possibility that some kind of electromagnetic activity along these fault lines that's subtler than overt earthquakes could be affecting human consciousness and creating the perception of strange encounters. And you've, of course, on the other side of the pond, you've got Paul Devereaux, the Earthlights researcher, who's investigated ancient sacred sites and stone circles and electromagnetics associated with those structures, and this arena of what are often called earthquake lights, the weird luminous phenomena that have an electromagnetic component that are associated with these types of events. Because, of course, again, the contact throughout history that humans have always had is often associated with balls of light, you know, as representations of perceived other alien others. And it all comes together, and then there's another British researcher, of course, Jenny Randalls has got some ideas on this, but there's another guy named Albert Budden, who published a really fantastic book called Allergies and Aliens, The Electromagnetic Indictment. It has a different name here in the States, but that kind of gives you a gist of what it's about. His idea is kind of that there is this collective unconscious, and that there are entities, archetypes in it that want us to believe in them, and so they will create physical constructions with whatever they have available, whether it be dust, or found objects, organized through powerful electromagnetic fields that interact with human consciousness. And since people have not only allergies to things like pollen and other chemical, biological allergies, a lot of people have electromagnetic allergies. And even though humans don't generally perceive their own personal electromagnetic field, you are surrounded by a variety of electromagnetic fields, the biggest one, of course, being generated by your heart and your brain. And these interact with the environment. Absolutely.
Wow.
And as you start to look at the literature that has delved into that, you come up with these amazing scientific experiments that could go a long way to explaining, you know, radical things like extrasensory perception and psychic phenomenon and that sort of thing. So,
wow.
So my ideas are basically hinged on the idea that there's a huge electromagnetic component that's important to understanding this electromagnetic phenomena that interacts with human consciousness, but that also is perfectly real and physical. I mean, these things, we know UFOs leave physical traces, and it's in those often these altered states that are created by these electromagnetic incidents or proximity to an electromagnetic field given off by one of these UFOs or devices or balls of energy, whatever it is, it's in those states that parapsychological data shows altered states are a great mode for transmitting anomalous information, or rather for anomalous information transmission. In other words, most psychic experiences occur on the edge of waking, the liminal state between sleep and awake, as well as in dreams. I mean, most people's experience of the paranormal is often, psychic dreams of one variety or another. So it seems pretty clear that, if humanity can communicate with each other through these anomalous cognition states, then why couldn't some other species?
Wow, that's a profound answer. I'm very impressed by that. So you have put a lot of thought into this UFO phenomenon. Based on what you think is going on here, do you think that we can get to the point that, so many people in the UFO world want, which is like some kind of disclosure, or do you think this whole issue is so complex and everything that it's just going to be impossible for the human mind to wrap around it?
Well, I'd rather be optimistic and believe that we can, under the right circumstances, we can definitely learn a lot from it, if not just about ourselves, potentially about our place in the universe and what the nature of these other consciousnesses are and why they interact with us. As far as disclosure goes, I'm pretty pessimistic. I've never been a fan of most of the people who've taken up the moniker of disclosure, specifically Stephen Greer and the exopolitics crowd. Mm-hmm. I know that he doesn't necessarily like to be associated with people using that moniker of exopolitics, but
it's all the same, folks.
Yeah, yeah. And at the same time, I have found myself acting as a Stephen Greer apologist back in, I guess it was 2002, when he issued a white paper saying, beware government disclosure, where he was saying, look, just because we're asking the government to disclose what they know about UFOs doesn't mean that we should buy wholeheartedly hook, line, and sinker whatever they tell us.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, in his paranoid and conspiratorial worldview, the UFO and aliens, because he absolutely thinks it's aliens in some classic sense, and that it's all about repressed technology like zero-point energy, and that it's all about, keeping the elite from having their empire toppled by these advanced technologies that we would, as humanity, have access to that could free us all from the yoke of imperialist police states. That's the perspective he's coming from, and I actually really respect that, because as much as I don't like his efforts, because I think he far too often mixes in people who should not be given anywhere near the level of attention they've been given, because they're obviously hoaxers, charlatans, and liars. And at the same time, he's had some of the best, most important witnesses as part of his thing. So when he did his first big press conference, I guess it was right before 9/11, I was both really excited that somebody was doing it, but when I saw the lineup, I was like, wow, one potato, two potato, three potato, four, this guy's, this one needs to be taken off the lineup because he's just, ridiculous. Like, I'm not going to name names, but the people who say, oh, well, I've investigated the, umpteen crash saucers, and I can tell you that there are 17 different alien species and that the government's in league with them. It's like, okay, fine. Maybe that's true, but you don't need to be on this lineup because you've already established what you think is going on here and what happens, but the media all goes to that one person because they've got the most sensational story.
Yeah.
Instead of the air traffic controller who's down to earth and has everything he can talk about verified on the tapes, the radar tapes.
Yeah, it's disappointing in some ways that ufology, they kind of, with Greer, it seems like they throw the baby out with the bathwater because of these extreme people that are in the mix. You know what I mean? Like you're saying, some of the people in the book Disclosure that he wrote, that has all the interviews and stuff in it, some of them are really good, but some of them are kind of crap, and people end up just throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying none of the stuff's any good when some of the people that he has as witnesses are pretty good.
Yeah. And now I will say, as an anomalist and a Fortean, I love data. I love anomalous data. I think some of the most important things can be learned from looking at the anomalies. And that's where I'm mostly so hypercritical of abduction researchers like Hopkins and others who, it's been known for some time and warned by people like Jacques Vallée that you necessarily attract the kind of data that you're looking for. And so the strangest UFO encounters are going to be the least reported by the individuals who've had them. So the stranger the encounter, the less likely it is to be reported. But it works in both directions. I mean, people like Hopkins are going to attract people whose experiences fit what he's already put out there as what he's investigating.
Yeah.
And he has himself said that, oh, you know, well, we throw out the ones that don't fit. And, you know, abduction researchers like Dr. Carla Turner, who is no longer with us, but she was, I didn't think she was perfect, but she was doing a lot of great research. And one of the things that she was doing was saying, well, we can't just throw out these anomalous cases that don't fit your prescribed narrative, your prescribed scenario of, you know, this, and this happened in the abduction scenario, and anything that is outside of that can't be real.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the same time that these sensationalistic people are claiming to have done government work for the government doing, you know, crash saucer retrievals, or who the exopolitics and contactees who say that, you know, they've been in contact with these different aliens, whether they're the Ashtar Command or, you know, the Semyases of Billy Meyer or whatever. You know, I find all that fascinating for its own different reasons. But if you're going to try to get disclosure, you have to go a much more respectable route.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you're just making a mockery of the effort and of the people trying to legitimately, you know, get some kind of authority figures like governments to address what you think is a real issue.
Yeah, and it seems like disclosure hinges on the whole ETH situation where, you know, I can't imagine disclosure in any form other than that. Do you know what I mean? I can't imagine the government being like, UFOs are real, that they're existing in another dimension, that you only can see at certain times and certain – you know what I mean? It's like that doesn't sound like it's even plausible. So it seems like disclosure hinges on the old – they're aliens. They're here from another planet. They're flying in on ships. Like
right.
The basic things.
And it is the modern myth. I mean, it's what makes most sense to your average Western-minded person. You know, it fits like, oh, well, you know, we do this. We, you know, send probes. We, you know, abduct and tag animals. We, you know, do these things that are often the staple of the abduction narrative. Even though there are plenty of absurd elements in them, it has a certain folksy logic to it.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to the possibility of disclosure, the fact is that I don't think the governments really know for sure what the hell is going on. And so, it makes it more sense for them to try and put out disinformation that might lead people to think that they know more than they actually do. Again, that's the very premise of Jacques Vallée's fictional work, Fast Walker. It was co-written with Mel Torme's son, Tracy Torme, who's famous in the science fiction television scene. They, you know, wrote this book called Fast Walker, the basic premise of which is that there is a super secret alien-oriented intelligence agency in the American military-industrial complex, and that they do have, you know, some technology associated with the UFOs, but that they really don't understand it, but that they're trying to convince the powers that be around the world that they do, which is one of the reasons I was really worried about the Cometa report that came out a little while ago?
Yeah.
As amazing as it is to have, that kind of a report come out, I felt it put far too much faith and stock in the idea that the American government or military establishment knew what the heck was going on regarding UFOs. And it almost seemed to fit right into that scenario that Vallée has been warning about for a long time. He started, since his 1979 book, Messengers of Deception, he started suggesting that certain human agencies likely have been studying UFO manifestations. And even if they don't understand the ultimate nature of the phenomena, have been capitalizing upon it and learning from its effects and turning it to covert ops, covert warfare, psychological operations, psychological warfare, and maybe using it for some very sophisticated social manipulations. Just like I'm saying that whatever the true UFO phenomena is, it's been with us throughout history, and if you look at its impact on the individual and the culture and the society, it's had long-term influence. And you know, it stands to reason that humans who have an agenda to protect, you know, their power structure, their culture, their society, through military overt and covert means, that's just another tool in the tool belt. And so I think Vallée, from a very early time, was warning the UFO community and humanity at large that, hey, look, you know, there's a real phenomenon, but there's also humans who are capitalizing on it and manipulating it and manipulating you and your beliefs through it. And that's been my main focus for a long time, is once I kind of accepted the proposal that I was trying to outline earlier about my take on the UFO phenomena, it's like, okay, yes, there's a real phenomena. It does have an alien otherness to it, but it also tells us about ourselves and the possibilities of other non-human consciousnesses. Beyond that, there's, to me, the more important issue is of how do we as humanity continue to move forward and find a better way of living together on this spaceship Earth and interacting with this phenomenon and moving into the future, because obviously we're at a time when things are pretty potentially catastrophic, and I don't, you know, you can look at it from any number of ways, whether you think we're on the edge of an ecological calamity or another global war or an economic collapse or all these different potential threats. You know, it's kind of an inevitability that we should really look at ourselves as humanity and try and let's go to the next level in as unchaotic a way as possible, so that as many people can benefit from these technologies that supposedly set us apart from animals in the best possible way.
There you go. Yeah. Well, let's hope so. I don't know. I'm pessimistic about that.
Yeah, I can be very pessimistic about it too. Yeah.
Just go to the shopping mall and you'll see plenty of reasons why. Well, let's move to the other sort of pillar of interest for you, and that's 9/11. It sounds like you really dug your jaws into this story once it happened. What do you think of the whole situation with 9/11? And then to piggyback onto that, what's your observation been on the evolution of the 9/11 movement? Because it's kind of one of the more unique stories in the paranormal world, in the fact that we get to watch a whole new branch of paranormal research, even though it's under the umbrella of parapolitics. It's still its own little world. We've kind of been able to see it start from the very beginning and grow and change over the last 7 years.
Well said. I'm fascinated by that. Yeah, I feel like in some ways, I mean, you know, Austin was my own little ground zero, to use a trite, and I'm sure that offends somebody, but I mean, you know, Austin has a very historic importance in a variety of things that touch on the realms of parapolitics and the paranormal. And growing up here and pre-9/11, having, you know, become a fan of people like Alex Jones, who, depending upon how you interpret the data, he predicted 9/11, and while he'd like to convince you that it was purely because of his ability to assess parapolitical data, it was also because he's psychic, even though he says he's not. That's a whole little special detail that I think I've talked to you on the phone about, Tim. And
yeah, when I was on your show, we talked about it.
Right. It's a little known fact that he has admitted on at least two occasions on his radio show that he has a history of having psychic cognitive dreams, and that besides the parapolitical data that was leading him to sense something was coming that summer, he said that he had a dream in which he saw planes hitting buildings in a New York skyline or something to that effect, and that was really the straw that broke the camel's back that made him go on his TV show and his radio show and say, look, call the White House and tell them not to carry out these terror attacks. I was a huge fan at that point. I was watching him religiously on Access TV, wasn't really listening to his radio show at the time much, but was... both invigorated, infuriated, and amused and entertained by his style and his abilities, and he started, you know, having investigated UFOs, I was already aware of certain, you know, say right-wing paranoid aspects of the UFO community, like Bill Cooper and others who were of the Patriot militia crowd, and I had been exposed to that kind of conspiracy theorist stuff, and I'd never really taken it with much more than a grain of salt. Having been raised as a, you know, liberal Democrat, I was more in keeping with the idea that government is good and the United Nations is the best thing you could imagine. And as I But what I, as I investigated UFOs, as I learned about, you know, the CIA's MK Ultra programs and their, you know, their policy of assassination and subversion in other countries to create quote unquote democracy, and as I learned about how, you know, our military has been used over and over again throughout history as a, you know, an enforcement racket for big business, and you can't butt up against UFOs with coming into contact with some of this data, and just the idea of cover up itself. I mean, the idea that the government would hide things from its populace, you know, I mean, just even basic things like that kind of led me to be questioning of everything political. And so I was primed that September 11th morning when I got up to complete the final stages of preparations for the September 14th, 15th, and 16th National UFO Conference. And in a lot of ways, when that second plane hit, I was not surprised, but I was terrified because I felt certain that this is it. This is the beginning of the end. That this signified, you know, the powers that be manipulating humanity towards the next dark stage. And it's been an amazing birth and growth of a new esoteric avenue of investigation, a milieu, what have you, as you were saying. Seeing these different conspiracy communities, you know, the, like I said, the UFO community has its own, has always had its own conspiracy underpinning, and Martin Kottmeyer wrote a fantastic article years ago called Ufology as an Evolving System of Paranoia. you know, and even people, even just the basic interest in Fortean phenomena in terms of Charles Fort, you know, the collector of damned data, there's conspiracy there. You know, the idea that anybody would suppress evidence, you know, Jacques Vallée's story about, you know, seeing astronomers destroying recordings of unidentified flying objects because they couldn't possibly be, so they had to destroy the data. I mean, that's cover-up. That's you know, whether it's at the behest of a government saying, you know, keep this from the people, or if it's just, you know, somebody afraid of ridicule, that kind of, you know, needs to inform our perspective on where we are with all this stuff. But with 9/11, there's so much data there. It's phenomenal. It is. There are so many anomalies associated with that day, and not just with the events of the day itself, but the days, weeks, months, years leading up to it, and now the data that's come out since. I mean, it's whether you marvel at the idea that a passport of one of the hijackers could fall to the ground unsinged after the fireball and the destructive power of whatever brought down those towers, it boggles the mind. And then, you know, a year later on the anniversary when lottery numbers, you know, 911 are drawn, and the baseball synchronicity and all these other weird things in the wake of it, it just kind of makes you go, well, you know, people like Alex go, oh, that's obviously a psyop. Somebody engineered that to, you know, drive home psychologically that, you know, 9/11 is still on our minds or something. Maybe, but, you know, I'm well-versed enough in parapsychological data to know that these kind of things can happen, and I don't mean just statistically. I mean they're statistically rare, and strange phenomena does occur, and sometimes it's, I think, paranormal. It's not a sinister cabal engineering a conspiracy in every case. The data with regard to the random event generators around the world going less than random before the first plane hit the tower is really amazing and intriguing information in a line of research. But that's all the paranormal aspects of this. The parapolitical underpinnings, you know, knowing the history of BCCI, the Bank of Criminals and Corruption International, or the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, their connection to all the Saudis and the terrorist networks and the Bush family, you know, the SNL scandal from the 80s, the savings and loan scandal that enveloped the Bush family and all the Bush brothers. All these things, you know, are there as a background, laying the groundwork of, at the very least, what people call lie hop, the let it happen on purpose scenario, which is still treason and still a war crime, and that is that basically, you know, this idea of blowback that well, you know, our policies around the world and our mucking about in other countries' business and our fomenting of rebellion and our funding of the Mujahideen and all these things, you know, created the scenario where we were just bound to eventually get attacked. And that's certainly logical, understandable, and like, okay, well, okay, let's start there. But there's a lot more that directly most likely indicates that there were moles in these various government and military operations who were giving information to these supposed hijackers and terrorists. I mean, how did they ever think they were going to thwart our air defense, for God's sake? How could a bunch of jihadists think that they could, you know, circumvent our billion-dollar defense?
Yeah.
You know, it boggles the mind. And yet, you know, there's so many areas you can focus on. You can go from a forensic analysis. You know, so many people are trying to prove that explosives brought down the towers. So many people are trying to prove what hit the Pentagon. And yet, you know, to me, that's not near as compelling as, again, the background, the history, the foreknowledge that these people had. You know, the fact that these different people encountered these would-be hijackers before the event and tried to warn the FBI. And when you look at how the FBI seemingly, you know, protected and coddled and tracked these guys and housed them in some cases, it's like, okay, now, somebody's head should have frickin' rolled.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, you don't reward people for mistakes, you punish them. And nobody was punished for any of the mistakes made on that day or that led up to that day. And as far as foreknowledge, we knew as early as, I guess it was 1997, the whole Operation Bojinka idea of hijacking multiple airlines and blowing them up over the oceans. And even right before 2001, there were several instances where, I forget if it's NATO and or the UN in certain globalist meetings, they had brought in special ground-to-air defense missile batteries because they were aware of the threat of supposed Al-Qaeda using planes as missiles. So all those reasons led me to, on that day and since, question everything that's come out. Even the things that support the various conspiracy theories. There's a lot of different controversial people in the UFO, in the 9/11 field, and I agree in part with most of them and disagree in part with even more of them. But I think that the planning by the people who really pulled this off went on years in advance, and that planning involved not just the planning for the event itself, but for after the event. And I strongly suspect that the 9/11 truth movement was engineered. I mean, they knew going into this that the internet exists.
Yeah.
And that would be the easiest outlet for facts that people might uncover and the easiest outlet for disinformation that could be used to cover up those facts. And just like the FBI and other intelligence agents of the United States have been practicing COINTELPRO since at least the 60s, and since all intelligence operations throughout human history have involved double cross and triple cross and shenanigans. I call shenanigans. you know, it's like, come on, you know, you can't. These people are dirty, and while, you know, you might want to believe that the CIA and the FBI are really acting in our interest, and even though they might have to get their hands dirty, that they're doing it for the betterment of our country, the fact remains that it seems like they screw up more than they help.
Yeah.
And whether it's the First World Trade Center FBI complicity, whether it's, you know, the BATF's complicity and foreknowledge in the Oklahoma City bombing, time and time again, it looks like, you know, sting operation is their backup plan. Oh, if they get caught before something gets carried out, they can always go, oh, we were just drilling for a possible terrorist attack, or this was just a test, you know.
Yeah.
So now, though, the truth movement, it's one of those things, it's like, I can't believe how many years have passed. It shocks me because it's still so fresh to me, and yet old hat in so many ways.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you know, it's like the Bill Hicks routine about JFK. Come on, Bill. That happened so long ago. just forget about it. Just forget about that, you know, coup takeover of the United States government, that assassination, you know.
Yeah.
It's like people now, they don't want to hear about 9/11, even though it's still, you know, Giuliani continues to exercise his reign as president of 9/11 by making reference to it every freaking chance he gets. So it's like it's still this point of manipulation of the populace, and yet people, it's already ancient history because, man, post 9/11, But even that phrase, it's like it's a different world, and everything's accelerating and has been for a long time, but that just kind of punctuated it, you know?
Yeah, it does seem remarkable. We had Greg Bishop on the show in January, and we were kind of talking about trends in the paranormal world, and it definitely seems like the 9/11 truth movement sort of peaked at the 5th anniversary of 9/11, and it's kind of been, I feel like it's sort of been petering out ever since, and it sounds like you're kind of saying the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's hard to estimate
popularity.
I think in some ways there's more people involved and there may in fact be more events going on. I think there's definitely more activism going on, but it's a new kind of activism. I mean, I remember, gosh, even in 2003 with the rise of iPods and you know, video iPods, it was like, you know, people could now come up to you in the street and show you a video of something, you know, or, you know, with these little portable DVD players even, they could, you know, somebody could confront you in the street and show you WTC7 and make you go, what do you think of this?
Oh, jeez.
And I remember when that started happening, it was like, wow, it was at the rise of the Alex Jones induced loose change phenomena of people creating their own mini documentaries and putting them out there for people to spread and it becoming viral in a really good way as a mode of activism. And now you've got this whole, you know, confrontational style of activism. It's almost more like not what others have called attack journalism or what do you call it, ambush journalism.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually. It seems like the 9/11 thing now, it's taking on a little bit of a militant edge to it. What's that guy, Don't Tase Me, Bro? That guy,
right.
and just a lot of disruptions and stuff it seems like they're into now. I don't know, that might be more in keeping also with what you're saying about how they sort of planned for this truth movement in the first place. I mean, if you're going to want to derail a truth movement like that, it would be good to have a guy on the inside who just causes all kinds of problems and you know what I mean, disrupts shit, and then next thing you know, it makes the whole field look bad.
Now, and I have real mixed feelings about that kind of approach. Certainly, my first encounter with this was Alex Jones's Access TV show, because he was from the very beginning, you know, that was actually the flavor of his research was, you know, he would go to meetings that normally would be just invited people and confronting people, like confronting George Bush, you know, long before he became president, and getting pulled out of the venue and driven around and then dropped off in the middle of nowhere, but getting it all on video, you know?
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing. And then confronting the then drug czar about the, you know, CIA bringing in the drugs and things like that. In a lot of ways, I think that can be really powerful, and it's important to make these people realize that they can be confronted at any time, thanks to the Constitution, with their misdeeds. And yes, that can create an environment and a scenario where, you know, somebody's there to hear this person speak, and they feel put upon because some wacko is disrupting the event. And, you know, there's a line to be walked there, but, you know, I'll walk it for myself and you walk it for yourself, and hot damn, there's somebody out there walking the line but going, okay, you know, I am going to confront this person and I am going to catch it on video. And I find that really empowering and fascinating, while at the same time cringing, because it's just like some of the UFO wackos, you know, there's these people out there that I'm just like, gosh, they're embarrassing. And it's the same with the 9/11 truth movement. There's plenty of people who I find embarrassing because they're, you know, like the surface literalist conspiracy theorists. They're, you know, the surface literalists, you know, ETH, UFO proponents. They're, you know, they're not looking beyond their own belief structure.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, you know, sometimes they have facts and sometimes they have dots that don't need to be connected. But it's a weird field. And it's been really amazing to watch it birth and grow.
Why do I have to always straighten you guys out?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Have a good weekend, knuckleheads.